And I want to welcome to the studio Finn Maxey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Finn is our permaculture man we bring in every few weeks to talk about permaculture, and we've been talking about the design principles of permaculture the last few weeks. And this week's one is obtain a yield. Mm. And that sounds like, well, duh, shouldn't you always be trying to obtain a yield from your what you're growing and things? So what? But give us what that the full picture of what that means and
so
what David Holmgren meant.
Kind of self-evident or common sense aspects to the permaculture principles, but there's actually quite a lot behind most of them. And the more I explore and understand them, the more I realize just how kind of nuanced and actually, the depth of this.
Yeah.
So, so as we talked about before, each of the principles has a whakatoki or a proverb, an English saying associated with it. And for this one, it's you can't work on an empty stomach. So again, like you were saying, duh, there's the idea of needing to have some kind of return on investment seems self-evident.
And your investment might be you planted a seed? Or you grew a garden, you did...
Well, what might be good is to step back and reflect just briefly on the previous principle that we talked about. So catch and store energy.
Yeah.
And so catching and storing energy is largely around saving and in kind of investing. So it is in some ways that idea of, particularly if we're talking about, say, like a fruit tree or a forest, is planting that seed. And so it's about investing in future flows of energy, I guess, as it were. Whereas, obtaining a yield is how do I ensure that the fruits of my labor are going to sustain me and my, whānau or whatever that scale of system we're looking at. So we're often thinking about net yield in this situation. And again, for people who go, I don't know what that means, so you, I guess, think of the idea of gross and net. So a good example of that might be actually not to pick specifically on industrial agriculture, but why not, is when we think about obtain a yield and, we put the carrot seed in the ground and we get a carrot at the end of it, is, that's a form of yield. But when we're talking about net yield, we need to consider all of the energy and resources required to produce that carrot. Do we actually have a yield or are we now in debt?
Yeah.
And so I guess that's one of the things that a fossil-fueled economy allows us to do is to essentially burn ancient sunlight and still obtain a yield, because our starting point is we have this incredibly dense form of energy that has been essentially kind of matured into this very condensed form over millions of years. And then we suck it out of the ground. And we can use it to grow food, which is how we grow modern food today. And so from an obtain a yield perspective, and people might know this out there, but just, putting it out, any guesses on the amount of energy spent for the amount of energy returned on, say, a carrot or a calorie? How much energy does how many calories does industrial agriculture spend to get one calorie in food? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, what I can figure is that because that the energy is so dense, it's very easy to use it in a very casual manner. And so we drive food all over the country to get it to market. We probably drive those seeds all over the country to get them to the farm and all the resources. So there's so much oil going into that. So it's not going to be a good figure. It's not going to be – it's definitely not a –
it's not
a positive figure for sure, and it's probably – multiple times?
It's an order of difference. So, and the figures for New Zealand are, well, I haven't seen any. So the best I can go on is they've done some really good work in the United States. And so again, their system is obviously more industrial and kind of larger scale, but I think the same ballpark. So 10 to 1. So
right.
10 units of energy go in to produce one energy out.
Well, it's been a good party.
Yeah, well, so that's exactly the concern there is, that has arguably kind of worked, not from an ecological point of view, but from a societal point of view, when you have cheap, abundant energy. But as we shift into a system of decreasing available energy, we just can't sustain that.
One thing it does mean is that there's a heck of a lot of opportunity for efficiency.
Absolutely.
Like, people talking about, like trucks driving ice cream from one side of Australia to the other, passing trucks going the other way, driving ice cream to the opposite coast from the other coast. Like, you know, there's all sorts of stuff there we just don't need to do. And it makes sense within the context of market economics, but not in terms of...
That's it. And there are all these scales to it too, right? So that's true at the local, that's true at the regional, that's true at the national, and that's certainly true at the kind of global scale. And because that's all of those... quote-unquote efficiencies are happening to make things as streamlined as they can.
Yeah.
So I guess another example of that, though, is, and a little bit jargony in terms of terms, but I think people understand the concept, is optimal foraging theory. So they've done a whole bunch of investigations of how different animals, I guess, work to meet their needs. And, you know, you can possibly imagine a lion on the
savannah.
On the savannah.
Let's go for
that. And it's going to spend... There's a point at which it's going to stop the chase of a gazelle.
Yep.
And so it has this internal intelligence, wisdom built into, you know, and this is at a species or at an individual, at an organism level, where it knows that... I am now at the point of spending more energy for the amount of energy I'm going to get from a successful hunt than I'm going to stop the hunt because I don't want to spend more energy than I'm going to get out of it.
You also get diminishing returns in terms of the energy level the lion has to chase.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
And so there is something in all living systems that has this kind of understanding of this principle that obtaining a yield isn't just about spending as much energy as you can so long as there's something left at the end, but to ensure that there's actually a net yield, that you get more out than you put in, at least from a thermodynamic point of view or a you know.
It's interesting, you know, Robs, who
I do who
does Kurataya, and I'll be interviewing him next Monday.
Nice.
And he talks about his experience going overnight in the bush. And he says it in the same way. He has a certain amount of energy, and that's what he does, brings you back, being in touch with that reality of the world that all our fossil fuels have taken us away from.
Yeah.
And so he knows that...
He doesn't want to have to walk all night to keep himself warm.
To keep warm, yeah. So he's calculating. And if he does have to do that, then he works out how to do that as well, so he can stop for 15 minutes, and that's just about how long it takes to cool down again. Then he can go again, so he's resting. But he's only got so many resources, and he had a trip down in the Nelson... Lakes. Forest near Nelson recently, and he was going to be two nights, but he limited it to one night because the energy it took to survive the first night, which he survived fine, but he knew he wouldn't have enough for another night if that happened. So that experience, that's one person we know who actually is putting himself where there are no fossil fuels in that.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so through that lens is that concept of this concept of or principle of obtain a yield kind of makes more sense, is it's about the energy we spend to sustain ourselves, and how do we do that in a way that is, I guess, kind of ecologically responsive and allows and isn't damaging on the system, because that's the other one, and I'll get into that in a bit. But this concept of, you know, obtain a yield at any cost, that's not what this principle is about. This principle is about kind of net benefit.
Yeah.
Net gain.
And so it's the same calculation. If I put this much energy in to produce food, will I make myself so unwell that I can't do that again next year?
Yeah.
As well as, will I produce enough to... Yeah, that's all factored in. We all know what that is. But when you live that daily, I think it's a different headspace to the one we're in now.
Yeah.
Where I didn't think about any of that when I got up and came to work.
I haven't thought about this for a while, but there was this quote that's always kind of... It really... struck a chord with me, and I kind of can't quite shake it because there's an eeriness to it. But David Graeber wrote this amazing book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
Yes, yeah. I've listened to some podcasts about it. I haven't read the book.
It's well worth it. It's extraordinary.
He's amazing. Yeah.
And so in that, he talks about a American journalist, I believe. I think I've got this right. Who goes to, I think it's the Kosovo region, but he basically finds himself in a... famine situation in kind of Central East Europe.
Kosovo.
Maybe. Yeah.
But part of the Croatian war, not Croatia, but...
I, It might be, and I'm sorry, Bosnia. It might be the Balkans, but I think it might have been further east.
There have been several wars since the 90s through
there.
Yeah,
and this was specific to famine, and I don't know if it was caused by civil war or war in general, or I forget the context. And so
it's a likely cause, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and the bit around this was that the journalist sees this family unit clearly in starvation mode. And they have these large sacks of sacks of grains of seed for the next cropping, and
you're gonna tell me to eat them.
Yeah, well, so that's what the journalist says. Is he's basically saying, "You've got food here. Why don't you eat it?" And they're like, "This is not food. This is next year's." Plants. And he was just like, "But you're hungry now." And he said, "We don't steal from the future." And it was just a matter of fact for him. There was no, and this was this old man of this grouping of people, and there was just no, in his mind, there wasn't even like, should we, shouldn't we? There was just a cultural value of, we just don't steal from the future. Doing this would be anti-future.
Yeah, and that's a cultural value that keeps the culture alive.
Yeah.
Joe Palaisha, who you'll probably be familiar with.
I know Joe.
I knew Joe. Well. Yeah, so I interviewed him many years ago around the time of those eco shows. They had a couple of eco shows.
Yep.
And he talked about his experience in Germany and well, Austria. It must be Austria, sorry. Yes, let's get that right. World War II and the family farm, and they planted some potatoes. Mm. And when it was time that they thought they should be seeing the shoots coming up, they're like, why aren't we seeing any of the shoots? And they went and had a look around and realized that there had been starving people displaced by the war in the forest watching them plant the stuff, and they went and dug it up. And that's a step beyond the starvation where you've got complete...
Well, that's cultural disintegration, right?
Disintegration, that's the word I'm looking for, yeah.
And so there is a... And I get that. That happens, right? So I guess part of this principle is about how do you... build systems that allow you to maintain stability and, I guess, control of self-reliance so that you can meet your needs, so that you're not in that situation of where you're not in famine or you're not desperate.
Yeah, so that's what obtain a yield means.
That's right. So it's about designing to provide for self-reliance at all levels by using captured and stored energy effectively to maintain or sustain the systems, and also to allow to be able to capture more energy. In a nutshell, that's kind of the essence of what this principle is about. And so you could imagine, as we've been talking about, moving into a future with less available energy and materials, being flexible and creative and being able to find new ways to obtain a yield will be critical. Because right now we rely on primarily global supply chains. You know, we rely on what's abundant. And so there's not this sense of tuning into the flow of things. Tapping into flows as they're available. It's about the expectation that, you know, at a flick of a switch or a turn of a knob, I'm going to be able to have unlimited energy, which is kind of how we've come to think of the world.
Yeah, and it's what's alarming and what was brought home to us by that power cut a couple of weeks ago was how dependent we are now on that, the efficient delivery of everything we need, and our lives revolve around it so that we can go to work and do the things we have to do. Yep. All that stuff has to be on tap.
Yep, that's
and
right.
And when it's not on tap, what then, you know?
And so what's interesting for me about that is one of the major issues around moving away from our current energy system is that kind of the need for on-demand, on-tap kind of energy availability. And of course, renewables are, intermittency is a huge issue with renewables. And so the wind's not always blowing, the sun's not always shining. And so renewables provide a challenge because they're incompatible with a 24/7 cultural expectation of supply, particularly and I probably, electricity.
And I probably wouldn't have understood that so well if we hadn't had what we had 2 weeks ago, which if anyone's listening to the podcast later on, it was a power cut that lasted 2 days, I guess, and was quite disruptive for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I guess from my biased perspective is typically, I imagine over the coming years and decades, energy cuts will become more and more normative. You know, I see the incredible challenges in maintaining a national power grid just the time and resource, the energy and resource required to maintain very large centralized infrastructure is enormous. And we, again, take it for granted because of the abundance of cheap fossil fuels. But
the irony is, as you've been, and you've been expecting that for the last 20 years, as that's been happening, the actual reliability of our electricity system has been increasing. And it needs to be like that so that the internet is available, because so many people need the internet to do their work.
Yeah.
So that's just, we're making the cliff higher.
That's exactly right.
It's really what we're doing there, unless we pull something out of the fire that we don't see coming.
Well, this is interesting.
To rescue us, but you can't rely on that.
No. And this is one of the things that I find really interesting about the permaculture principles, is the more I dive into them, the more I realize, you know, there's a lot of kind of theory and, you know, quite a bit of rigor associated with them. And so there is a lens here around kind of game theory. And for people who are familiar with that, I guess the idea is that, or who aren't familiar with it, is how can I, let's see if I can just at a high level describe game theory. It's about those strategies that are most effective now benefit those who apply them. And so you either kind of have to keep up with or adopt strategies that provide immediate advantage, and those that don't then typically get outcompeted. And so it's a really tricky thing. For example, violence and war generally win out against peace every time. And so
in the moment, when
in the moment, that's right. And so you have to be able to kind of almost outcompete, or at least outsurvive other systems that are trying to impinge on you. And so from a game theory point of view, it makes sense that systems that most effectively obtain a yield and use it more effectively to meet their needs prevail. You know, that's just that's what happens. But based on what you've just said is, you know, when we look at kind of a wider systems boundary, so when we're not just looking at short-term gain, when we're looking at kind of the long system and ecological health and a whole bunch of other considerations, we realize that, you know, this system is unsustainable. And so those who can obtain a yield through other means and diversify their way of maintaining a yield and ideally work with natural systems and natural flows, if they can continue to do that, well, this system kind of wanes, as you said, you know, we're building a bigger and bigger cliff to fall from. So game theory suggests that, you know, we need to ride the wave and we need to plug into global industrial systems. But the more we do that, the more vulnerable we are to any changes that happen at anywhere along within that global system, whether it's supply chains or any kind of political fallout that might have national ramifications.
So this system is producing a huge surplus, and we could be using that surplus. I know you and I aren't seeing any of it, but we are. Let's be honest, we have a certain level of privilege, but most of the surplus is going to the people at the upper echelons. But that surplus could be used to prepare for a step change, or to make the system more efficient so that it can last longer.
Yeah, I don't think. I think more effective, I think, is what we want. We want a more flexible system, not a more efficient one.
Okay, that's a good point. So it's machine thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think efficiency is useful. Like, for example, if I'm building a rock wall, or, you know, there's a time and place to reduce the amount of energy spent, but efficiency is the trade-off of efficiency is vulnerability. You know, if something's really efficient, it's also usually very vulnerable.
Because nature is not efficient.
No, not... Well, it is, but a 2-to-1. So generally, I think there's a general ratio of there is as much redundancy as there is efficiency. So there's 2 resilience for 1 efficiency, if that kind of makes sense.
But you look like a blossoming tree.
Yeah.
Like there's hundreds, thousands of blossoms.
Yeah.
If a human engineer made a tree, designed a tree, they'd have one blossom, one piece of fruit.
Strong as, that was
to do the next tree.
Because we love robustness, and we don't necessarily understand resilience.
And why have 2 blossoms when 1 will do?
Yeah.
Because that's a waste of time.
So that's really interesting, because that dovetails into another element of obtain a yield, which is this kind of maximum power principle. But how do we do things in a way where we can try to maximize the likelihood of return on investment? And so, you know, a tree doesn't produce as many leaves as it could, as to optimize the total possible potential of solar photons coming from the sun, it only does about half of the potential. So instead of, like you said, it doesn't produce one leaf to photosynthesize, and it doesn't produce, I'm creating an arbitrary number here, but like 100 and it doesn't present 200% of the leaves it produces, which in theory would be the optimal amount of energy from the sun that it could harvest. It goes for, you know, 100%, or, you know, in this case, 50% of what the total yield could be. So it produces lots and lots of leaves.
It has spare capacity.
It does. It has spare capacity, and it has and redundancy. Yeah. So if some of those trees wilt, atrophy, blow off, whatever else, the tree's not going to run out of an energy source. And so there is something in this obtain a yield where we're not trying to maximize, you know, we're not trying to build bigger and bigger pipelines to get as much, you know, the metaphor that I've heard a lot is, you know, this idea of slurping a straw when it comes to oil extraction. We're not trying to make a bigger straw. Well, that's what we are trying to do. That's what industrial consumer society. But wiser humans would realize to try to optimize the size of the straw, which actually probably at this stage in life is about contracting it, constricting the size of it so there's less and less flow, so that we can find a graceful way where people can maintain quality of life. And I guess those people in less developed circumstances can actually increase the level of access that they have, but at a global level is trying to wean humanity or fossil carbons. You know, that's what a wise living system would do, is they would find that sweet spot of how do we use this amazing energy that we've got, but do so in a way that allows us to both maintain to sustain our needs now, but also kind of invest in future resilience and that kind of spare capacity that you're talking about. We don't do that. We try to make everything as efficient as possible so that there's no wait times, there's no extra storage. You know, we do that in our supply chains with food. You know, we have, what, 3 days worth of storage? You know, so if for whatever reason there was some interruption to cargo ships arriving with food, you know, within 4 days we'd have serious shortages on supermarket shelves. We grow enough food, we grow enough apples in New Zealand to feed us, but we don't have the domestic supply chains to actually get the food to where the people need it.
Yeah.
And that's all about efficiency. It has nothing to do with kind of resilience or self-reliance.
I keep coming back to that there is huge capacity in our system, but the surplus is all going, like, there should be easily enough surplus in our system to plan for a different future and get it into place and have it working and functioning. But we're all... everyone else is, people would be listening, going, I don't feel a surplus in my life. I've been more and more squeezed, and it's just the, I hate to use the word capitalism again because some people will switch off, but it's the capitalist system which is working for the people at the top, and they've got the surplus, and maybe if some of them looked at what was going on, maybe some of them are preparing. Well, I know some of them are preparing. They're buying up high country blocks in the South Island to use as a bolt hole when civilization falls apart. Some of them are literally doing that.
I think my only challenge to what you said would be that idea of surplus, and coming back to this principle of net energy is our current model of means of production is typically about extracting wealth and converting it into another form of wealth, and usually, again, at a loss. And so we're taking something miraculous like a forest
yeah,
and then turning it into dollars.
So we have a temporary surplus.
So we have a temporary surplus, but also it's not a net surplus. You know, there's usually a net deficit. So we're actually degrading our life support systems. We're degrading our actual wealth, and we're converting it into other forms of wealth that, again, have less value and meaning. I mean, financial capital is pretty useful right now because we can use it to kind of acquire any others, which is, I think, is your point, is if we take the financial surplus in our system,
then
we can reinvest that back into human capital, into cultural capital, into natural capital, into all these, into built capital, all these other stores of wealth that actually provide for independence, flexibility, creativity, all these other things. Whereas if everything just gets squeezed into financial capital, then there's a whole bunch of dependencies that get built into that, and we can't themselves.
Yeah. And that financial surplus is being used for the wealthy elite to have a very fancy super yacht in several ports in Europe that they see one weekend a year. That's what the financial surplus has been used for.
You have greater insight into how one percenters live than I, but I'll take your word for it.
I don't really.
Yeah, but I take the point though. Is that actual value? You know, and I'm sure they enjoy those yacht trips and whatnot. But how is the system itself benefiting from that use of surplus?
Yeah, well, purely within that, what economists call the economic system, it's beneficial to build super yachts like that because it provides employment, blah, blah, blah. Yep. But in the context that you're talking about and the wider system that the financial system depends on and the environmental system that the financial system depends on, there's bigger issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And
our yield, we've obtained a yield and we've given it to Playboys to make super yachts.
Yeah, or the system has obtained a yield. And so I guess this is interesting too because...
And again, that's a financial yield, to your point.
Yep.
It's not a yield in terms of the planet and the system that feeds us.
So I think that's a really important bit to jump back to is this idea of yield, I guess, more generally. And we're in this context, yield isn't extractive. It's not producing profit at the expense of.
Okay, you know, that's the definition of yield
for you
today.
Yeah, well, within the permaculture realm is this idea of obtain a yield isn't, it's not extractive. It doesn't diminish the system. It's taking, so I guess, you know, using financial metaphors is the difference between the interest and the stock, I guess, as it were, the initial amount versus the interest. And so obtaining a yield is about... the interest, it's about the flow, it's not about the stock, if that kind of makes sense. So we're not diminishing the health and function of the whole system. We're just tapping into some of the surplus that it generates to meet our needs.
Yeah. So this can be depressing to think about and cause us to worry about the future. How does a permaculturist handle that?
Yeah, well, so I guess for me, I don't think about this as, or this doesn't lead me to feel any kind of sense of despair or worry about the future. I guess what it does do is it has me rethink about the choices I'm making in my life and where the opportunities to make change. And I guess as a goal is how do I become increasingly in control of with myself or with others? You know, again, there's levels of scale to it to start increasing my ability to create a yield. And so whether that's planting a fruit tree or, you know, a lot of small acts add up to quite an amazing amount of abundance that we can tap into. And things like fruit trees, I think for me are maybe one of the best examples of the obtain a yield is, you know, for the time and effort required to plant a tree and cost if we're buying one, is the return you get is pretty amazing. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who loves grapefruits and I was at a nursery and I was, you know, I forget what the price tag was. Say it was, you know, maybe $60 or something for a grapefruit. And I was kind of affronted a bit in terms of like, wow, that's grapefruits aren't that hard to grow. And, you know, and so I said to him, do you know how much grapefruit grow? And he was like, I don't know, $80, $100. And I was like, no, only 60. He was like, that's pretty good value then, isn't it? And I was just like, actually, when you say it like that, he's like, how many years of production are you going to get off that thing?
Yeah.
And what's the market value equivalent? You know, if that starts yielding after 4 years and then it just keeps yielding more and more every year, you're dealing with tons and tons and tons of fruit. That's worth way more than $60.
Yeah.
And so it was just that reframing for me of going, oh, yeah, that's right.
And that's the way you should think about it in terms of the yield, obtain a yield.
Yeah. And, you know, there are some assumptions in there. It does require people to have space to plant a tree. It does require people to have the know-how to... you know, keep a tree healthy and good condition. It does require people to have enough financial resource that they can spend $60 on a fruit tree and, you know, without having to then the family go hungry. And so, you know, there are some dependencies, but you can start small and just keep building these, you know, kind of ways to keep obtaining yields that that we can, again, tap into on a regular basis.
Yeah. All right. Look, we've kind of come to the end time-wise. Have you got something you want to leave us with? I thought you've got... Finn always had lots of notes, and I see there's still quite a few notes that you probably haven't had
the
chance to...
Oh, that's all good. Yeah. So I guess one thing I will say is I think how obtain a yield and the things that we're talking about does kind of align in this, you know, permaculture view or aspirations for the future and where it started. And so I think, you know, well, someone like David Holmgren would say, you know, that the original vision of permaculture has kind of largely failed in terms of having a significant societal impact on industrial society is, you know, it is about contributing to a change process, and that change process more broadly in society is about moving from dependent and demanding consumers to independent and responsible producers. And so I guess it's, you know, part of the encouragement, I think, of what permaculture offers is how do we increase our self-reliance? And this obtain a yield, I guess, is one way of thinking about it. What can I do with my skills, my abilities, my time, my resource to find new and different ways to obtain a yield that don't degrade the wider system around me? And and that's why I think generalists are so important, is because we don't have one income stream, as it were. Yeah. And again, income can be financial or otherwise. So I guess that's, yeah. So this principle for me is really about thinking about, you know, how do we have diverse, quote-unquote, incomes or yields that we can draw on? And that builds our self-reliance, that builds our resilience, and that builds our ability to be kind of generous and giving, if that makes sense. You know, the more yield I have, the more I have to share.
Something I notice is that permaculturists are always talking about abundance, and capitalism is always talking about shortages.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that, I know that's a huge generalization, but that I certainly don't hear anyone else talking about abundance apart from permaculturists.
Hmm.
Yeah. All right, Finn, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.